Rob.
And I'm Dave.
And you're listening to Alternate Galaxies, where we're back, Dave, to talk about the second of the Star Wars prequel movies, Attack of the Clones, from 2002.
Yes, we've had some interesting feedback from our chat about The Phantom Menace, and we're now revisiting Attack of the Clones.
Yes, we've had some good feedback over the past month, so I'm sure there's some people out there just itching to hear what we're going to say about this one.
This is probably going to be, for a lot of people, the least predictable take, I suspect.
I think that's fair to say, actually, but I think there's plenty to say about it which they might enjoy hearing as we get to that conclusion.
I hope so.
Dancing around it too much.
And, of course, this month, as per last month, we are talking about a 22-year-old film, so we're not doing non-spoiler and spoiler. We're going to dive into spoiler. If you haven't seen it by now, I'm sorry, you've had plenty of chances.
Now, with these kind of discussions, we like to kick off with, you know, where we were at the time and how we came across the film, when we saw it, all that sort of good stuff. I've got quite a bit to say here because, Dave, I'm going to kick off with the first thing I remember about the film particularly is the name reveal for the film. This is before we had a trailer, before the film came out. They revealed the name, and when Attack of the Clones was announced, there was a section of fandom that went crazy in a bad way about it. They thought it sounded ridiculous. Another section of fandom, maybe a smaller but better read, more rounded part of fandom, defended it along the lines of, no, that sounds bang on, like a 1940s serial, and that's super fitting, because that's where Star Wars comes from. But I do recall, despite the name thing, the teaser trailer itself was well received, but I'll pause there to see if you remember the name thing.
I actually don't remember much about the lead up to this.
Oh, really?
At all. This came out in my last year of university, where I was very much putting fandom behind me, and particularly Doctor Who fandom. This was at that point where the telemovie had long ago come out, and it was clear Doctor Who was going nowhere, it seemed, in 2002. Yeah. You know, I was getting ready to finish uni, enter the workforce properly, and so a lot of fan things just weren't really on my mind. I certainly wasn't involved in Star Wars fandom, so I was very much just a very generic member of the public in the lead up to this, going, okay, the last Star Wars movie came out. It wasn't great, but it was entertaining. Let's see what they do with this one. And I was certainly aware that when they mentioned it was Attack of the Clones, people who are more into Star Wars said, oh, the Clone Wars. And I said, okay. And they go, no, the Clone Wars, the ones that Obi-Wan mentions. I'm like, does he? Okay. So I was very, very neutral on this.
Okay, then. Oh, that's very interesting. You were a civilian at this time, Dave.
Pretty much, yes.
Interesting. Well, I mentioned the trailer was well received, so I'll skip forward to that. The teaser trailer only went for a minute or so, and people might remember it had the sound of Vader breathing in the background. No other sound until some drum beats right near the end. It was just basically the Vader scuba gear breathing, whatever they used to use that make
that
effect.
That's right. I did not remember that until that moment.
So, yeah, it forced the audience to look at the visuals, which is something Lucas is very good at, as I've mentioned on the previous podcast. So here's 3PO with his skin on. Here's a bloke who looks like Boba Fett but isn't. Here's Coruscant. Here's lightsaber action. There's Watto. Here we are at the Lars homestead. There's R2-D2. There's clones. Oh my God, more lightsabers. It got people really excited. There was a good buzz around it.
There was. You're prompting some memories there, Rob, and I think that's all very correct. Yes, absolutely.
Mm. And looking back, it was maybe a weird thing to do because Vader isn't in the film. This isn't the film where Anakin becomes Vader, you know, and it was certainly a more overt thing than showing just the shadow of Vader in the Phantom Menace teaser poster. But put that aside, it was trading off Vader in a big way that I don't think was really earned by this.
Well, I think there was a big perception, rightly or wrongly, there was a perception that one of the two big weak links of The Phantom Menace was Anakin Skywalker, and particularly Jake Lloyd's performance. As we discussed last month, a lot of that actually quite unfair, but that was a perception at the time. And I think that they were trying to say, okay, look, if you didn't like the little kid last time, don't worry, because we're a lot closer to Vader now than we are to little kid.
Fair enough. As for actually seeing it, though, similar to The Phantom Menace, this was another midnight screening for me. oddly, I have no real memory of who I was with. Possibly the uni mate I mentioned back in the Phantom Menace podcast, although at this stage we're about 7 years on from uni and I think we'd fallen out of contact. It was possibly my first wife, as we'd gotten hitched a couple of years earlier. So she was in the mix and she was a sci-fi fantasy fan. I know I definitely saw Lord of the Rings with her, but I'm not sure about this. So who knows? While I can't remember that, I do remember my reaction, and it was one of major disappointment. I felt the film had some really cringeworthy moments. I think Anakin was a pain. I felt it looked too fake most of the time, and I was really upset with it. There's my opening salvo. How about your first time, Dave?
So, once again, I went to a multiverse-organized midnight screening at Hoyt's on Bourke Street. Mm-hmm. I know I was with my Doctor Who fan friends. Richard was there. Rob from 42 to Doomsday was there long before he was Rob from 42 to Doomsday. Mad Dog Morgan, I'm pretty sure, was there. Victor was there. You know, it was that sort of group. Mark Chuck Harding was in his wilderness period at that time, so he wasn't there, as he pointed out when we discussed this the other week.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a midnight screening with actual organised fans, people who you know wanted to come to this particular screening. And I will talk a bit later about some of the reactions to a few moments that came across in that. Now, Rob, I walked out of that actually pretty satisfied and thinking this was a significantly better film.
Oh, really?
And my long-standing memory of this is that it has always been the film I have said is the best of the three. And I've spent the last 22 years defending this as the best of the three against some pretty ferocious fire.
Yeah.
I've learned to understand what it must be like if you don't think that Empire is the best of the first trilogy, just, you know,
right.
what a minority must be and how forcibly people will argue against you. And certainly over the last few years, and anytime you go on social media and you do one of those, I've ranked all the Star Wars films and I have clones above the others. People go, that's just crazy. That's just mad. And I have started to doubt myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've started to think that maybe I've been wrong for 22 years. So I went into this rewatch for the first time in quite a while. Certainly for the first time in quite a while, I've watched the whole thing, wondering if I've been wrong all these years or if I've been right all these years.
Okay, well, let's talk about the rewatch. What are our opening thoughts for it? I mean, my opening thought for the rewatch is, yeah, all the bits that were bad seem just as bad or worse, and all the bits that were passable don't seem any better. Some have aged a bit as well. I didn't find this very interesting or even overly entertaining to revisit. So rest assured, I have a lot of notes in front of me.
Interesting. Okay. I took a reasonable amount out of this rewatch. Stepping up from the last movie, I definitely think that most of the action scenes are better. There are more of them. I'm going to argue maybe one too many. We'll talk a bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some very good action beats in this that I think work quite well. I think that there is a hero, there is a lead in this movie, which steps it up from The Phantom Menace. But the big thing for me is that when we talked about The Phantom Menace, I said there are a number of scenes where I just can't work out what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve, how this works in plot terms. What I found watching Attack of the Clones back is that I could very consistently see what it is that Lucas is trying to do, what beat he's trying to hit, what emotional note or what plot arc he's trying to submit in there. Do I think that all of them work and all of them are well written? Definitely not. But consistently through this movie, I could see what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
And that does put it above The Phantom Menace as a starting point.
Wow. Okay, so we have a point of divergence already.
Okay.
Watching this for the podcast, Dave, here in 2024, I was reminded of something I've pointed out to others in recent times in other discussions. And that's been with the return of Hayden Christensen to Disney series like Ahsoka and Obi-Wan. Everyone has been like, oh my God, it's so good to have him back. People are just crying and going gaga for him like he's some long-lost savior. Yet you watch this film, maybe you're seeing it for the first time, and you would legitimately think, why? He's stilted. He's weird. He comes across almost serial killer-like, and then later actually massacres a bunch of women and children in the desert. And Padme still wants to shag him after that. Maybe we can get to that later.
Mm-hmm.
Then you realise, ah, fans are actually in love with the Anakin from the Clone Wars animation, who was written differently, he had better stories, he wasn't even played by Christensen. Because you watch this and you think, why on earth would anyone be in love with this guy? Interested maybe to see what he does and how he behaves, because we know he's going to be Vader one day, but not in love. And it's so strange, Dave, it's even created this weird sort of mini cult who are now like, can you believe how hard Hayden was done by, you know, back in the day? Justice for Hayden. And you think, well, no, I was there at the time. The character of Anakin was disliked because he comes across as a perverted creeper and a real dick in most of his scenes. And the way Christensen is directed to play him, and I stress that, directed to play him, is just bizarre. He was disliked for very clear reasons back in the day.
Okay, let me wade in.
Yes, please.
I disagree with a certain amount of what you've said there, so that's always good in a podcast.
Yes.
I think that there are a number of things to say. First of all, it's very important to differentiate between Hayden Christensen, the actor, and Anakin Skywalker, the character, and I'll certainly do that in my rebuttal. I certainly think that Hayden Christensen generally is a very capable actor. I think that he's particularly good in My Life as a House. I think he's very good in the character he has to play in Broken Glass. And there are moments in this where I think he's actually really good as well. And I'm going to say the fact that you pulled up how dislikable he was and what serial killer vibes he gives, I think is an indication that in those moments, his performance, Christensen's performance, is actually very good. Mm. I think that when he's asked to do that darker stuff, he gives a very good performance. When he's asked to be creepy and sort of show that there's some dark tones to this, and this is the guy who's going to finish up being Vader, I think Hayden is actually very good. The scene where he's talking about, you know, I killed them all. The scene where he's regretful, the scene where he's worried. I think those are actually really good scenes and really good performances. I think he does give very stilted performances when there is exceptionally stilted dialogue. Mm. And Lucas particularly cannot write flirtation. He just cannot write flirtation at all. I think that the love story in this is one of, if not the biggest problem with the movie, and Christensen does not have the gravitas or the depth or the experience or the talent to deliver really stilted, flirty dialogue that Lucas has written well. He is poor in those. But I think he does give a solid performance when needed. I think he does sell the idea that this guy's got something very dark going on under the surface that we see bubble up from time to time. He does that really, really well. And look, let's be honest, he's also very pretty and that doesn't hurt. And I think that there are going to be people who are like, well, okay, I don't care. The guy's pretty. I like it. That doesn't hurt. But I think that Hayden does a pretty good job where it counts. The problem is that Anakin, as you say, is an arsehole. Mm. Anakin has a fascinating relationship with Obi-Wan. And I talked about you can see what they're trying to do. They don't always do it well. I can totally see that they're going for a really tense relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan, where Anakin deep down knows that he is more powerful than Obi-Wan and is frustrated that Obi-Wan keeps pushing him back and pushing him back. He's got that arrogance of youth and that arrogance of talent that says, stop pushing me back. As much as we're friends, I resent you. And I think Christensen's resentfulness comes out really, really well in his performance. And Obi-Wan, I got the feeling deep down knows that actually, yeah, this guy is more powerful than me. And if he wanted to take me, he probably could. And therefore, I've got to be really cautious and I need to sort of slap him down. And if I get this wrong, he's going to go on the wrong path. And I think there's a really good tension that they're going for. Now, does George Lucas write sophisticated enough dialogue that they can properly portray that in the film? The answer is no. Mm. I can see what they're trying to do. It doesn't quite work. And the result of that is that if you get it in the wrong mood, Anakin just comes across as a whiny bitch. I think there's more to it than that. But if somebody says to me, this guy's just a whiny bitch, I don't disagree. And I can see how that would be your takeaway.
Yeah, well, the question is, where does this come from? Because when we last saw him, he was still a little kid excited to be a Jedi Knight and all sort of yippee about things. And now he's this. And I know Lucas is directing him to be this sullen James Dean type, and he's doing the best he can with that. I just don't think it was the right move. Short of having adult Anakin in the first film, which I think would have been the best thing all round, this film needed to sell these two guys as brothers, as great mates having wacky adventures. And then the events of this film, like Shmi's abduction and her death, have an effect on him so that the third film starts with an older, angrier, war-weary Anakin because he's fought through the whole Clone Wars by the start of the next film, which sells the downfall. Instead, the third film starts with them as great mates having fun adventures, and it's this film that starts with Anakin being darker and weird towards Obi-Wan. It just doesn't gel for me. I sort of get that maybe it's a teenage thing, but when we last saw him as a kid being so excited, and now the very next film it's this, it's very jarring to me, actually, as a character.
I totally disagree. I think that it is the right move to now see Anakin at, what, 17, 18 he's meant to be here, I guess.
19,
there you go. So I totally get that at 19 he feels this resentment, he feels he's been held back, he feels that people don't recognise his talent, and he's become resentful for that. I think that his emotional turmoil that has not been reconciled from his time as a slave on Tatooine is all there. So I actually think the stuff with him and Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan just trying to keep this guy under control, is the right dynamic to go for. I don't think it quite lands because of the dialogue, but I think that's the right thing to go for. What doesn't then work is to simultaneously have him fall in love with Padme, or more to the point, have Padme fall in love with him. Mm. He gives off horrible stalker vibes all the way through. And when you said that some stuff has aged badly, I would not be shocked if that's perhaps what you were referring to, because I noticed that as well. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. He gives this crazed moment where you see the emotional turmoil of Anakin after he's killed all of the sand people. And Padme's like, oh, well, do you want to make out some more? Yeah. So I think the Obi-Wan stuff works really well for me. It's the Padme stuff that completely falls down, and not least because they can't do flirtatious dialogue, and they have got the infamous, let's talk about it, the infamous I don't like sand scene, which is some of the worst dialogue in television, filmed in some of the most wonderful locations.
Yes.
Absolutely beautiful, stunning locations,
yeah,
but terrible dialogue. So that's where I think he falls down.
Okay, well, let's talk about Padme, because I get that Padme is no longer the queen, and she can be a bit more loosey-goosey with how she presents herself and how she operates, although let's note she still uses decoys, who are happy to get blown up on her own account, which is interesting. In some ways, maybe she's just coming into her own as a woman. I think she's meant to be about 24 here. You know, she's been pushed down this political path from a very young age. She talks about it in the film. But I don't know, Dave. She goes from thinking of Annie as still being the little boy, because he is 5 years younger than her and still a teenager, then witnessing him being a total jerk to his master, later admitting to murdering that village of people, to then, as we talked about, falling in love with him and delivering dialogue, which just sounds atrociously unrealistic, and then wanting to marry him on top. Like, in the space of a few days. Like, I understand that's a progression. I get that it's a progression. She's gone from no interest to marriage. But it's such a bizarre progression. I think to myself, is this really the assured, tactical, smart queen from episode one, who was only 14 at the time? I don't think it is.
I said earlier that I've seen other performances from Hayden Christensen before he did Star Wars, and that, you know, really helped me defend him in his performance here. I think that in the 22 years since this came out, I've seen enough very good performances from Natalie Portman that I now know that she is a good actress. I couldn't have told you that from this movie. I think her performance is incredibly stilted. I think when you look at some of the documentary and behind-the-scenes stuff that they film on this, she just looks utterly, utterly baffled and bamboozled.
Yeah.
She's trying to get direction from George Lucas, like, what am I trying to feel here? What's going on? He's like, just jump around. We'll put the CFO. Yes, da-da. Yeah. That's all. You know, it doesn't matter. We'll do it in post. Just move around. And she's got no clue what she's doing. I think that she's an actress that needs that direction. She doesn't know what's going on. And that shows. I think it's a very ordinary performance. But again, what could she do with that dialogue? And look, I will happily say that there are other things in this film I'll defend. I will say that the whole romance is complete and utter tosh. Mm. Doesn't work, doesn't land, isn't believable. I can see perhaps what they're trying to do, as you intimated before, Rob, that she is this young woman who's sort of been stuck in this world of men, you know, older men particularly, mm-hmm. and probably hasn't had a chance to date. And suddenly she's got a very handsome guy interested in her and she's like, oh, wow, I quite like this. But again, the dialogue doesn't sell that.
No.
If they'd written a little bit of, you know, if that scene in the meadow, which again, beautifully shot, lovely, lovely location. If that scene in the meadow hadn't been, I had my first kiss when I was 12, had just been, well, actually, no, I grew up surrounded by old men. I was a servant of the state. I've never had a chance to, you know, meet other boys. I've never had a chance to be romantic. I've never had my first kiss. And it's a like, but here I am with a bit of a hunk. Mm. I've got these feelings. Oh, my God. You know, what? Let's try this. if it was written that way, I think we'd have a lot more sympathy for Padme.
Yeah.
But and I think that's perhaps what Lucas is trying, but he doesn't have the skills to write it.
No, not at all. Moving on to the third of our leads, if I can call them that, Obi-Wan, played by Ewan McGregor. He is very much the mover and shaker of this film, for sure. And I think he works fine, although there is that, and I'm going to drill down on this just for fun, he is painted as a bit of a dummy in that scene, Dave, where he's got the coordinates for Kamino, but nothing's there. And then we have to take it to the kids, to the younglings, who boil it down. Well, it boils down to, well, if you know the planet exists and you have the coordinates, but, you know, computer says no, then someone's messed with the computer. It's like, duh, like, that wouldn't have been one of his first thoughts. We needed that scene with the younglings. It's just another weird bit in the script in this film.
As I looked down at my notes, I did write down that from his very first scene in the movie, Ewan McGregor is just very good. He is now the star of this movie. He's the hero of this movie, which
yes.
I know we debated whether there was a hero in The Phantom Menace, but I think unambiguously Obi-Wan is the hero of Attack of the Clones. And he's just instantly in control. He's instantly having fun. You instantly get the feeling that this is a guy who enjoys life and he loves being a Jedi and he loves having his wacky adventures. And I think that that's really strong. I think he gets a lot of good moments through the film. But I also did note that that moment is just embarrassingly bad. And again, it's a case, I think, of the scriptwriter saying, I want to have this moment where the kids can be putting it together with the younglings and with Obi-Wan. And so you have the whole, gravity's pull is there, but you cannot see the planet. What does that mean? And all the kids can go, the planet's hidden. Yeah. And that's a nice idea. And I'm sure if you're a kid, you go, oh, well, I've solved it. But a more capable scriptwriter would have realized that you're making Obi-Wan the dummy
yes.
to do that, and that doesn't work. And I think that's just a very good example. And let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Of Lucas's approach to this film. Lucas is all about the next action beat. How do I get to the next action beat? And I think the action beats in this film are actually pretty strong. And moving between them is the weaker part here. But everything happens to get you to the next action beat, to get you to the next big set piece. And this is, I think, probably the most famous of the behind-the-scenes documentaries where you see the footage of Lucas directing. And it literally is just, I'll just move around. We'll put it all in post. We haven't done the effects yet. We haven't pulled it out. Just move around. And the actor's going, okay. And they're just sort of jumping up and down and dodging imaginary things, knowing that something's going to be put in later. He doesn't care about the emotion of a scene. He doesn't care about the performance. He just wants the action. Mm. And also, that's the one where you famously see, and the guys at Red Letter Media, if anybody who watches their YouTube videos have highlighted this, you see time and time again where all these sort of lackeys and stooges surround George and like, oh great George Lucas, oh Lord of Star Wars,
yeah.
we need a decision made. What do you think? Oh, I'll do it this way. Do it this way. And oh my God, the wisdom.
Yeah.
The wisdom, George.
Yeah.
And nobody's willing to go, hey, George, I see what you're going for, but can I give you some constructive feedback here? Nobody's willing to do that. So you just get George's vision, and George's vision is, how do I get from fight to fight to fight?
Yeah. Something you were raising there was the CGI, basically, you know, telling them to jump around and they'll do things in post. I think this is worth talking about, the CGI, that is, because aside from the scenes in Italy, which is Naboo, which you've mentioned out there on the lake, or in Tunisia, which is Tatooine, this movie is one huge green screen extravaganza. It's an orgy of CGI, as I called it last month, Dave. And CGI just wasn't up to doing the heavy lifting back in 2002. I especially remember Lucas crowing that we didn't make one suit of clone trooper armor for this film. You know, we never put real actors in clone trooper armor. And that was like a major achievement for him. And maybe in a technology wonk sort of way, that's exciting. I get that. But it really shows up on screen. It looks terrible graphically. I thought it looked terrible 20-odd years ago. Most of the time, there's like almost a haze that seems to cover the background to hide that the graphics aren't great. Again, Italy and Tunisia, they're great. They almost seem like Phantom Menace outtakes rather than part of this film. But they're rare. Most of this film is very, very CGI based, and I don't like the look of it at all.
Yeah, I'm less fazed by that, but I do agree with what you're saying. I absolutely agree that Italy and Tunisia are the standout parts of this movie, and they look fantastic, and that's to their credit. I agree that the everything being the servant of the CGI means that a lot of people struggle. There's a scene particularly that I saw where Samuel L. Jackson has to get off a sort of a transport and run off into the desert or something, and you can see Jackson sort of obviously just jumping from one lump of blue cloth to another. And you can see on his face, he's going, I don't know what I'm looking at. I don't know where my eye line's meant to be. Am I meant to sort of keep running? Like, what's happening here? And he's just clearly being told, oh, just jump off that onto here. And someone of Jackson's standing as an actor is going, this isn't enough. I don't know what am I looking at? What am I standing on? Mm. Oh, we don't know yet. And that is a struggle. I think that the worst of the scenes is the factory scene.
Yeah.
I think that is frankly dull and badly designed and just doesn't work and not needed for the plot. I said earlier that I actually think most of the set piece big sort of fight scenes in this are actually really good. I think the speeder chase to open the movie is very well placed, rather than having the pod race sort of in the middle of the Phantom Menace, where I felt it really sort of dragged down 20 minutes in the middle of the movie where you should be ramping up. I think having a speeder chase in the first sort of 10 to 15 minutes is really good, and I was sold on Coruscant as this big city. I think that looked actually really cool. Mm-hmm. And most of the scenes sort of go on from there. You get a fight between Jango Fett and Obi-Wan that's, you know, the right place in the movie and really works. You then build up to the big fight scene in the arena, both the one with the animals and then the one where it's the Jedi versus the troops. So that's your big scene, and then you get a more personal and tighter fight with Dooku at the end. I think they all work really well. They're in the right place in the movie. They all look pretty good. The factory scene is the one that I just go, you've stopped the movie for 15 minutes for a scene that doesn't look that great, doesn't add to the plot, and frankly, it just turns this from a nice 2-hour movie into a bloated 2-hour 20 movie. And if you took that 15 minutes out, I think the movie would have been much, much better.
Well, it's like something out of Looney Tunes, isn't it? We've got, you know, C-3PO's head knocked off and stuck on another battle droid. And the one that really gets me is when Anakin, his arm is outstretched and some big metal stamping machine comes down and stamps his arm. And initially I thought, oh, okay, that's the robot arm, so that wouldn't have hurt. Then I realised, oh, hang on, he hasn't got the robot arm yet. That big stamping machine has just come down and smashed his arm, but somehow it's okay. It's just made like an outline of his arm in the metal. Like, this literally is a Looney Tunes cartoon, because then he just pulls his arm out and he's fine. Like, even though this industrial machine's just stamped him. Like, oh, God, that's terrible. Yes, I hate that bit of the movie.
Yeah, I actually remember seeing that, and it would have been about 2 a.m. by the time we got to that scene, and thinking, oh, this is how he loses his arm.
Right. No. No, it's not. But you would think that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, I don't hate the graphics as bad as you do. I do think they have aged in some parts. The explosion right at the start where the stunt Amidala gets blown up, that looks terrible.
Yeah, very much so.
I think that Kamino looks pretty cool, and I like the whole ocean planet. I think that's probably the strongest of the scenes for me in terms of graphics.
Yeah, well, it's dark, so you've got darkness sort of hiding some of the detail. You know, if that was set in broad daylight, it might not look as good. It's dark and stormy. Dark and stormy always works, so I can deal with that, you know. Dave, in our first podcast on The Phantom Menace, we talked a lot about Jar Jar because the fans were really down on Jar Jar. He is notably turned down in this film to the point that he's hardly in it. And I think that's surely because of the fan reaction to the first movie, like we discussed on our first show. Perversely, though, they do leave him in to hand emergency powers to Palpatine. So even if he's not goofing around and falling off battle tanks and juggling bombs and being a Warner Brothers cartoon character this time around, even with limited screen time, he still does something colossally stupid in this film. Which, to be fair, starts with Padme being colossally stupid and putting him in charge while she goes home. Again, that doesn't strike me as the move of the assured tactical smart queen from episode one either. I think that's another weird misstep in the script.
I certainly remember some fan commentaries, and definitely amongst my sort of small circle of fan friends, that not only was it a deliberate decision to lower the amount of Jar Jar screen time in this movie, but also it was a bit of a, okay, fans, you hate this character so much, we're going to give him a really stupid decision so you can all laugh at him, and we're all laughing at him as well, and it just proves we don't like him either. You know, that sort of been quite a deliberate decision.
You think it was?
Look, I don't know that it was, but it certainly sort of feels like, okay, well, look, if they hate him, let's all hate him together, and we'll make him the accidental villain of the piece, so to speak, which is an absolutely astoundingly dumb moment for the movie.
Yeah, I agree.
Can I drill down into a couple of things that I really struggled with in this movie? Because I've talked about how I get the intentions, I like some of the performances, and I've talked about I quite like some of the action beats.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think this really fell down is a lot of the individual details of the plot, particularly around Count Dooku. Lucas does here something that he's going to become quite known for, of introducing characters as though we're meant to know who they are. And if you come into this movie cold, as I did back in the day, you have no idea who Count Dooku is, and it's not really explained all that well who he is, why he's rebelling, why the Separatists are going with him. Again, I get what they're going for, that Palpatine is trying to set up a civil war so that he can create an army that will eventually become the Imperial Army. I get that. That isn't really particularly well explained. And what I think also is a problem is that they continually refer to him as Count Dooku, and only twice in the movie is he mentioned as Darth Tyrannus. Mm. There's the moment on Kamino where Obi-Wan says, oh, well, who ordered this army then? And they say, oh, well, it was Darth Tyrannus. He's like, well, I don't know who that is. And it's not till right at the very end of the movie that he meets Sidious. And Sidious says, ah, Darth Tyrannus, my friend, you're back. And I think you're meant to go, oh, I've joined these dots. This is awesome. But he's mentioned so little that I think you're not meant to really get it. I think it's not really clear that he is a Sith. No one refers to him as such. Yoda doesn't go, ah, you're the Sith, or anything like that. And that's really to his detriment. If I was rewriting this movie, I would just forget about the title Count Dooku full stop and just call him Darth Tyrannus from the start. Make it very clear that he is the baddie of this movie, that he's the new Sith. You could maybe leave some ambiguity as to whether he's the master or the apprentice. That might be useful. But make it very clear who this guy is and why he's the baddie, because I think it doesn't quite work. And before I hand over, I'll also just note the other big problem that comes from all this is that, okay, Obi-Wan discovers that this Darth Tyrannus guy working for this other Jedi who's long since dead guy has ordered a clone army. And it's like, oh my God, who's ordered a clone army? Why have you ordered a clone army? What's that for? And then at some point it's clear that it was ordered for the Republic. And by the end of the film, Mace Windu and Yoda and Obi-Wan are going, oh, thank God we had this clone army ready. I mean, it took them 10 years to build and we don't know who ordered it, but oh, who cares? We've got our own clone army to play with now. That's convenient. Let's just forget that and move along. What?
Oh, a few things to unpack there. I mean, I'll start by saying the movie initially says that Jedi Master Sifo-Dyas ordered the clone army, and then it sort of becomes ambiguous as to whether Sifo-Dyas did it or whether Count Dooku did it as Darth Tyrannus, because I think it's Jango who says, I dealt with a man called Tyrannus.
That's right, yes.
And you start to wonder, well, was Dooku pretending to be Sifo Dyas? Because certainly Sifo Dyas comes into it somehow. But you'd think if Dooku had tricked Sifo Dyas into doing it himself, and it was Sifo Dyas who went there, wouldn't Sifo Dyas then go back to Coruscant? I mean, he's a Jedi Master. He'd be on the council. Hi, dudes. I'm back from Kamino. I've just ordered up some troops.
He's my expense. Here's the receipt. Here's the invoice you have to pay.
Yeah, I had a burger on the way back. So that's really clumsy, both from the point of view that we don't know whether Tyrannus did it or pretending to be Sifo Dyas, or Sifo Dyas did it, and then why wouldn't Sifo Dyas mention it? Or did he just die too conveniently after that for them to ask him? Because we know he's dead by that point in time. So that's all really quite messy.
Yeah, I think it's by far the most complicated and just... I think clumsy is a better word, the clumsy part of the plot. It doesn't hold up, right? From why did you do this? How did you do it? Who is he? Which guy's which? Oh, and how did no one notice that we've just got a clone army conveniently?
Yeah, and I agree with you completely with the Jedi there. They know this clone army has been made in a really dodgy way under really weird circumstances. And yet none of them stop to think, are we being played here?
Yeah.
You know, of course, without the clones, we don't get the cavalry coming in at the end of the film, and it's essential to all of that. I get that, of course. But in terms of the story, the Jedi's reaction to and their embrace of the clones is really weird. Yes.
Yeah, and they could have got away with it if, after using these clones, imagine Obi-Wan turning around to Windu and just saying, look, I'm really glad you brought these clones, but huh? And Windu said, yes, we're now in a position where we have to use them, but I don't trust them. I don't know what's going on, but the genie's out of the bottle and we're now stuck with them. I think we need to be very, very cautious, fade to black. Like something like that to just acknowledge it, because otherwise Windu and Obi-Wan and Yoda all seem really, really, really dumb.
Agree. Agree completely on that. We mentioned Jango a moment ago, and I don't think we can get towards the end of this episode without talking about him further. I mean, Jango is quite an interesting character. I don't think he's used well, even in the Coruscant scenes, which are meant to make him seem mysterious, just seem weird. Like, he's the top assassin, but instead of assassinating Padme, he hires someone else to do it. And actually, instead of her doing it, she then leaves it up to a drone and some, you know, some bitey caterpillars or something to do it. That's weird. His fight with Obi-Wan in the rain is pretty good. You mentioned that a moment ago. Even if I do think the background looks a bit fake, I think that would look 1,000 times better if it was shot today with the LED screens that they use on The Mandalorian. That landing pad in the middle of the ocean would have looked fantastic and not like a PS3 game if they had had that technology back in the day. Because the fight itself is great. One of them doesn't have a lightsaber, doesn't even have anything that really counters a lightsaber, yet the battle feels quite even between them due to the way Jango fights. It's a good fight. And I'll just end by saying I think it's a shame that he's killed off in one film. He's the Darth Maul of this film. I think that character had a bit more to him, maybe.
Looking back, I think you're right. I think at the time, everybody just saw Jango Fett as a way to get to Boba Fett.
Right, yeah.
You know, he was an instrument to get there, and I don't think anyone was quite expecting that the actor would be quite so charismatic. And like Darth Maul, everyone would latch onto him and regret that he was only in one film, but he was very clearly decapitated, so we can't go there. You mentioned the caterpillar thing. Look, I agree that sort of, you know, he hires him to hire her to hire the caterpillar is a bit too much. But when Anakin comes in and lightsabers the two caterpillars, I did sit there and go, ooh, he's very good at precision lightsabering. He's got some talent, that kid. So I thought that was quite nice. Because, you know, to cut the caterpillar in half without slicing open Amidala is, you know, it takes a bit of precision.
Yeah,
so yeah. I liked that. I want to just mention a scene that I thought was really good, and another to defend Hayden Christensen, is the moment where he meets Watto.
Yeah.
And that's really underplayed by both of them. I thought, actually, that's really nice. And in fact, all of those moments, I think, on Tatooine are actually quite good, and there's some quite good cast in there. They're suddenly in a real location. They've suddenly got real things to interact against, and that works really, really well. We obviously have C-3PO in there. Once again, if you'd taken C-3PO out of this movie, I would not have missed him at all. But as we discussed last month, he's got to be there.
Yeah, like I say, those scenes with Watto, it's almost like a Phantom Menace outtake.
Yeah.
You know? It's like we're back in that film, and it looks so much better to me. I can't underplay that. Now, Dave, the sports desk is coming up. I've got a couple of things to mention. I'm sure you've got some yourself. I just want to throw this out here, the topic of Sydney. One thing that really annoys me, on top of this film being annoying in general, is the fact it was made in Sydney. For the first time, Star Wars had taken production away from UK studios and they had come to Sydney, my hometown, Dave, the Emerald City. And while the Sydney cast and crew aren't responsible for this being a stinker, I mean, they didn't write it, they didn't direct it, they didn't produce it, all of that. The fact Star Wars came to Sydney and the actors were out and about and it was this really exciting time, which I actually remember quite vividly. I'd drive past the Moore Park Studios, you know, Monday to Friday, and I'd think, you know what? Natalie and Ewan are probably in there right now filming Star Wars. And then this was the result. I felt annoyed and almost embarrassed for my city. I know it's not your city, so you might not have much to say on this, but I just wanted to throw it out there.
No, fair enough. I get how you feel, but no comment from me.
Okay.
Something positive I want to throw out, and this is also my second last point, is I think the score for this is spectacular. And Rob, I know this is going to be a controversial take, but I actually think that the Across the Stars suite used in this is the best piece of music that John Williams has written, certainly for the prequel trilogy, if not for Star Wars. I know a lot of people really love Duel of Fates in Phantom Menace, and that's really good. And there are some great stuff. I think the Imperial March is really memorable. It's not an amazing piece of music, but it's very memorable. The Force theme and the Love theme and Yoda's theme from the original trilogy are pretty good. But I think Across the Stars is spectacular. And the way that it's woven into this film in various different points is really good. The build-up to it as they are taken out, ostensibly to be executed, is really good. The build-up and the mix of it in the end with you have the Imperial March and that dark music merging into the joy of Across the Stars, at which point you go, hang on, this is not work, this is not good. It's just really, really good. So look, we all know John Williams is phenomenal. We all know he's a big part of why Star Wars is successful, but I want to give him bonus points for this movie. I think it's his best work. I actually do. On Star Wars, he's got better work in other movies, but in Star Wars I think this is his best work.
Okay. My last point before we get to the sports text relates to the music as well, because I've known for a long time, Dave, that we both rate Across the Stars very highly from the soundtrack. And it's weird for me in the sense that I don't buy the love story in the film at all. This isn't a case of something like Close Your Eyes from Buffy,
yes,
which actually thematically doesn't feel too different from Across the Stars, sort of this, you know, slightly doom-laden love music. When I think of Across the Stars and these two leads, I feel nothing at all. I think their romance is forced. I think there's no chemistry. I'm not rooting for them. I'm not happy that they get married in the end. Nothing. But I agree, this piece of music, ostensibly about their love, and maybe that love is slightly doomed, is just really beautiful. So I concur on that 100%.
Oh, good. I'm glad that we've got a nice moment of agreement right towards the end of this episode. The final point I want to make is to talk about that final lightsaber duel.
Yes.
I've been on the record as saying that I think most of the prequel duels lack the emotion and the intensity of the ones in the original series or the original set of trilogy movies. This is probably the better one of those. I do like the way that Anakin's boisterousness and impetuousness is what gets him knocked out very quickly. The way that he and Obi-Wan fail to work together is what allows Dooku to work. It is incredibly obvious that Christopher Lee can't move except when he's a stunt double, which is unfortunate. And I do remember when this happened on screen at the midnight screening and Dooku has that incredibly stagey line, "We will have to settle this with our knowledge of a lightsaber." And everybody goes, "Oh, is he going to?" And Yoda pulls out the lightsaber and he dances about and everything. And that was a you know, moment where a lot of fans did cheer. I do remember that very, very well. And that brings me to sort of the big point that I wanted to make here before we go to the sports desk. Because back when this movie came out, my group of fan friends were all sending chain emails to each other and replying, and, "Oh, what about this thing? And what do you think of this thing? And what about, how did this work? And how did this play off?" And all the rest of it. Very similar conversation to what we're having now. That sort of level of depth. One of the group who hadn't been replying up until this stage hit reply all, and he said to us, "And Rob, you're going to have to get a couple of beeps ready for this one."
Okay, I've got my finger on it.
He just said, "Guys, quit all the analysis, and he spent analysis with anal very clearly emphasized, said quit all this analysis, it was a fun film, and in the end, Yoda danced around like a what's not to love, move on. And right. I think there is a take of this movie where you can just say, you know what, some of it looked great, it had lots of cool action, we got from where we had to go to where we had to go, as a piece of entertainment, maybe it did just work.
You know, 20 years on, I still don't know whether I like it or not. And I know it happens again in the next film. We have Yoda bouncing around in the Senate chamber with the sort of redux of this fight, except he's fighting Sidious there. I honestly don't know if I like it or not. In the theatre at the time, I think because of the reaction of the people in the theatre, I think even when... he does like a kung fu sort of move, doesn't he? Does he put his hand out and just sort of gesture at Dooku? Like, you know, come on, bring it sort of thing. And I think when he did that, the theatre went nuts. Then he started bouncing around and everyone was clapping and cheering. And I got carried along by that. But then watching it later, maybe on home video, I was like, oh yeah, this is silly. This is really silly.
Yeah, I'm still like you. I'm actually on the border for that one as well. I get the funness of it. I get the moment of it. I also get the ridiculousness of it. Yeah, I still don't know how to feel about that one. But I think if we went this whole thing without mentioning Yoda jumping around, like, we would be remiss.
There is a gag in, though, which I think does work, and that's after jumping around, he then returns to just shuffling like he's a broken little old man.
Yes.
And that's kind of funny.
It is. And you get to see Yoda actually using the Force. You get to see him fighting and resisting. I'm not quite sure why Obi-Wan doesn't roll out of the way of that great big collar rather than making Yoda just hold it above him.
Yeah.
But no, there's some good moments. And again, if you're a kid seeing this, I could imagine that would all be pretty cool.
Yeah. Shall we go to the sports desk?
We better, yes.
Here we are at the sports desk where we look at the player of the week, the foul of the week, and the player of the week. Dave, do you want to kick us off with your play of the week?
My play of the week, Rob, I was umming and ahhing about this until I got to the very end and I suddenly remembered what I thought of that ending when I was in the cinema, which was wow. And it's the two scenes back to back. It's the scene of the clone army being assembled. They're sort of saluting Palpatine. He's on the balcony and you can see all the different reactions. Palpatine's being absolutely neutral. That blue horn guy is sort of like almost got, you know, orgasm face. Just, oh, wow. you've got Jimmy Smith sitting there being sort of like, I'm really upset about this. I'm really worried about this. You've got that begun the Clone War has moment as the ships that every fan goes, that's an early model Star Destroyer. Oh, wow. You get all of that going on and that's a really cool moment of just what's happened here. And then you jump back to Italy and Lake Como, absolutely gorgeous part of the world, I've got to say. You jump back to that and you see the wedding and the music builds, and the music's fantastic. And even though it's meant to be this wonderful wedding, this consummation of love, every fan goes, this is going to end even more badly than the Clone War is. And the combination of the two and the way they hit the emotions left me, the first time I watched it, just going, wow. And it left me this time when I watched it just going, wow. So those last couple of scenes, that last minute, my play of the week.
Yeah, it really is like Romeo and Juliet managed to get together and not kill themselves beforehand.
Somehow.
But are still doomed.
Yes.
And I'll just say on the Star Destroyer thing, what gives fans a real Woody there, Dave, is the Star Destroyers are in atmosphere, as the fans would say, you know, which is something we had never seen, you know, actually taking off from in atmosphere and flying through in atmosphere to get up to space.
Absolutely.
That was a big thrill for fans.
Very cool.
My play, if we were going on subtle moments, I'd say it's the scene where Obi-Wan is strung up and Dooku comes in and is all blustering. Oh, they've gone too far. This is madness. And seems to want Obi-Wan to help him overthrow the Sith. And you don't know if he's lying or not. I always found that a really good scene. But for the big scenes, and this is what I'm going to go with, it's the arrival of the cavalry at the end when the Jedi have circled their wagons in the middle of the arena, figuratively speaking. they know they're going to get gunned down, but they're going to take out as many droids as they can. And it's actually quite tense, because you see that there aren't many Jedi left and they're crowding into this small space. And then the gunships fly in, blazing away, and it briefly becomes a Vietnam movie, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That shot of Yoda in the doorway as they fly in, it's pretty awesome looking. And that initial moment, the gunships fly into action, I really like. I think the later battle gets a bit too computer gamey and a bit too just CGI extravaganza. But when you have the gunships fly into the arena, oh man, I love that.
Very understandable.
I'll continue on with Foul. We've discussed this, or at least you've mentioned it several times, and I agree completely, and I've been keeping my powder dry, so to speak, every time you've said it. And that's making Anakin and Padme the core of the movie, making a good chunk of this movie the love story. I think it's a real misstep. I don't think that's what people come to a Star Wars film for, and making that love story happen between two people who have less chemistry than a glass of water is quite nuts. I mean, we spend all this time with these two, and it's like, So this is what Star Wars has become, huh? You know, is anyone invested in this happening at all outside of maybe a small teenage girl audience? If that, I don't know. That's my foul.
Yeah, if I was going for sort of a big esoteric thing, I would absolutely have done the same thing. And look, we both agree on that being the weak point of the movie. But I've gone for a very specific moment. And you mentioned it earlier, Robin, I kept my powder dry. And that is the moment where Jar Jar just dooms everybody by voting emergency powers to the Chancellor.
Yeah.
Because all through this movie, I've kind of been carried along with it. I've said that some dialogue doesn't work, but I'm like, okay, the dialogue is not good, but I see where they're doing, and the dialogue doesn't work, but I see what the character's meant to be doing, and there's other stuff that I've really enjoyed. But that was a moment I've just gone, Jar Jar, you're an idiot. That is just so mind-bogglingly stupid. It's incredibly stupid that the Senator left you to do it. It just is not believable, and I just thought that is just such a badly written, badly executed moment, and plus it's got Jar Jar in it. And look, I was willing to excuse Jar Jar a bit in The Phantom Menace as being part of the tone of that movie and something kids would like. In a movie that's getting darker, his moments are just don't fit. They just don't work. Yeah. And so Jar Jar, particularly that moment, is my foul this week.
All right, who was your player?
This was tough. I thought about John Williams, but I thought that's probably a little bit too easy. I came very close to Ewan McGregor because I think he does make this movie work in many ways. But I'm going to be controversial and I'm going to give it to Hayden Christensen. I think he struggles with the bad dialogue, and I forgive him because that's George Lucas's fault, where he has to convey darkness and turmoil and irritation and all the things that set him on the path to being Darth Vader. I think he actually does a really good job. In some ways, as we talked about right at the start, Rob, he perhaps almost does too good a job because too quickly the audience learns to hate Anakin. I think it's a really underrated performance. I'm, by the narrowest of margins, giving it to Hayden Christensen.
All righty. It's honestly slim pickings for me here. And although I have a perverse sort of idea to run in from left field and give it to Christopher Lee, who no one probably has top of mind because he's not in that much of the film, I think I've got to go with Ewan McGregor again.
Yeah.
He carries a lot of the film. He has a couple of great fight scenes. He has some cool lines. He is likable, whereas Hayden isn't. Yep. I don't think anyone else really comes close to his impact and his role. That said, I don't think it's anything too groundbreaking either. So again, slim pickings for me here.
Yeah, look, if I hadn't given it to Hayden, I would have given it to Ewan, so totally get where you're coming from.
All right, to wrap up, Dave, last episode, I said I was and I wasn't looking forward to making this podcast, and in my mind, that was quite a simple statement. I was looking forward to the podcast because I always enjoy sitting down and discussing a piece of media with you, Dave, always. So that was beyond question, but I wasn't looking forward to it because I think this is a shocker of a film. The plot meanders all over the place. Indeed, it's less of a plot and more, here are some things that are happening sort of at the same time, and it just gets us to the finish line. I returned to the comment in the episode one podcast, and I've made it again in this one, that we should have started episode one with an adult Anakin. That's an Anakin who could have noticed Padme in a legitimate way. You know, he wouldn't be a child, and maybe not been her cup of tea, so that by the time this second movie came around, if she started to have feelings, it would feel more like a natural progression. Sort of like Han and Leia in A New Hope and Empire. But as it stands, that stuff doesn't work, and this movie, for me, is just terrible. The script is bad, the visuals are bad, the acting on the whole is bad, the direction is bad. It's by far and away the worst of the prequels for me, arguably the worst of the first six episodic films, and possibly even the worst out of all nine films for me.
Wow.
I know that's a big call, Dave, but for me, this is the pits, 4 out of 10.
Just let me let me resuscitate myself, okay?
I'll have a cigarette while you do that.
Okay. Look, it's very clear we react to this film in very different ways. Mm. And nothing you've said, I'm sitting there going, did what, Rob and I watch the same film? Not at all. I totally get where you're coming from. And what you're saying makes perfect sense. But this is one of those things where it lands differently for different people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a lot more forgiving of this film. I think it is a definite step up from The Phantom Menace. I think the themes make more sense. I think the themes are more interesting. They're not well executed occasionally. The script is not great in a number of places. And a number of the performances aren't great. But does it engage me? Does it make me think what's going on? Does it have enough twists to be interesting? Does it have enough action beats to keep me entertained as just a piece of fun space adventure? I think that it does work. I'm a lot more forgiving of Hayden Christensen than I think you are, and I'm a lot more forgiving of the graphics than you are. Did I like this enough to give it an A plus or an A or an A minus? Absolutely not. I gave The Phantom Menace a C plus. I give this a B plus. I think it's a near miss. It's not perfect. It's not an A minus, but it's got enough in it to keep me going. Is it still my favourite of the three prequels? I'm not going to say until I've rewatched and had a chance to give this level of destructive analysis to Revenge of the Sith. I think it would be very unfair to do it until then. I'm very open to it not being, because I have really seen the faults here. And that's probably where I'll end up. The stuff that I remember enjoying, I have enjoyed. Again, the stuff where it fell down, I think it, you know, really showed its problems for me. But there was enough for me to get by and give this a near miss, a B plus.
Yeah, and look, in return, I can see what you mean when you say it's different to The Phantom Menace. I can see how it's structured differently. I can see how the beats would work better for you. So I can actually see why you like it. It's just not for me for the reasons I've said.
Very reasonable. But next month, we're going to be back doing Revenge of the Sith.
Yes, we are. I can't wait for that one.
Yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting discussion. I like it when we disagree, Rob, and we'll see if we do again next month.
All right, fingers crossed that we do.
All right.
Until then, I've been Rob.
And I've been Dave.
We'll see you next time on Alternate Galaxies.
You've been listening to Alternate Galaxies, the podcast where Rob and Dave from The Doctor Who Show take a look at other great sci-fi and fantasy that we think Doctor Who fans might like. You can reach us at hello@thedwshow.net, on Twitter @thedwshow, or on Facebook /thedwshow. Alternate Galaxies is an irregular podcast, so stay tuned to The Doctor Who Show and other programs on our feed to know when the next episode's coming. Our theme music is called Wretched Destroyer and is by Kevin MacLeod. Find him at incompetech.com. Well, that's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye!